I'm pleased to introduce our keynote speaker, Dr. Robert May. Undergraduate and graduate training in chemical engineering and theoretical physics is an unlikely beginning for most ecologists, but it's precisely the foundation upon which Bob May built his career. I'm not certain what stimulated his early interests in animal population dynamics and community complexity, but his mathematical prowess, his clarity of thought, quickly moved him into the top ranks of ecological theoreticians. His impact here was immediate, far-reaching, and has been long-standing. His work was among the first to question then-conventional theory about the supposed inexorable connection between diversity of communities and stability of populations. Somewhat later, he demonstrated that relatively simple nonlinear difference equations could generate surprisingly complex behavior and thereby introduce chaos theory to biology and ecology. His work has strongly influenced so many important areas, including factors underlying the maintenance and loss of biodiversity in the tropics, to the epidemiology of HIV/AIDS, just to name a couple. His early years began at Harvard, then to University of Sydney. For those of us in ESA probably know him best in his years at Princeton from 1973 to 1988. He left Princeton in 1988 to take a Royal Society research professorship at Imperial College, actually jointly with the University of Oxford. In 1995, he became chief scientific advisor to Her Majesty's government and head of the British Office of Science and Technology. From 2000 to 2005, he served as president of the Royal Society. The list of Dr. May's accomplishments and awards is awesome and, I should say, awe-inspiring. I want to call attention, though, particularly to the fact that he was the second recipient of this society's most prestigious research award, the Robert H. MacArthur Award, which he received in 1984. And I think it's interesting to note that he actually gave the MacArthur speech in 1986 here in Milwaukee at the meeting of the Ecological Society of America. In addition to those awards, he received the Medal of the Linnaean Society of London in 1991, the Marsh Christian Prize in 92, the Frank Medal by the Zoological Society of London in 95, the Crawford Prize in 96, and just this last year, the Copley Medal of the Royal Society. In 2001, he was created life peer by the House of Lords and chose the title Baron May of Oxford. But I'm pleased to introduce you to you here more simply as Lord Bob May. Lord May, we welcome you back. We look forward to your address, which is entitled Ecological Science and Tomorrow's World. Thank you.
Well, it's a very great pleasure for me to be here. It's a long time since my last Ecological Society of America meeting, and an even longer time. It's 36 years since my accidental transmogrification to become an ecologist, which is rather sobering when I look around and realize that many more than half the audience weren't even alive then. But even then, it was clear how large were the ecological and environmental problems that were looming. People like Garrett Hardin and Paul Ehrlich were already warning us. And so what I'm going to do is first, at a rapid gallop, I'm going to summarize for you some of the objective facts that speak to the magnitude of the global problems that humanity faces. These are the big questions that are implicit in the ESA agenda and which make this meeting so much more important than the usual academic annual meeting of the society. And against that background, and rather rapidly and selectively, I'm going to sketch some of the progress, some of the quite remarkable progress that we have made over the last 20 years and 30 years and 40 years in understanding how populations, communities, ecosystems work and how they respond to disturbance. Before I do that, I'm going to pause for a commercial. And before I even do that, may I say, the people standing round the edges, there are plenty of seats down the front if you want them, though that's a disadvantage. If you want to walk out, it's more embarrassing. Now, the reason I have this commercial is twofold. Firstly, I promised Ian Sherman I would do it. But secondly, it is to just remind us how much ecological science has matured over the last three or four decades. I mean, ecology is a very young subject. The word is not much more than a century old. This is your 93rd meeting. The British Ecological Society is a bit older, but there is no ecological society that is 100 years old. And much of the history of ecology has been laying the foundations in descriptive, Tycho Brahe things. The last 20, 30, 40 years have seen the maturation as it acquires, based on that empirical, experimental, laboratory, observational field basis, acquired a more theoretical, conceptual base. Other areas of biology did it quicker. Evolutionary biology in the form of population genetics had gone through that transmogrification in the first half of the last century. Other areas of life science that think of themselves as Newton but are still Tycho Brahe, like, say, immunology and much of molecular biology, which are still in a descriptive stage, haven't even reached the truly theoretical stage. And it was interesting in producing with Angela MacLean this third edition of Theoretical Ecology to look back at the second edition 25 years earlier and recognize how much things had changed, how many more assumptions you could make about the average educational background of ecologists. And the mathematics is not that important. It is just no more but no less than a way of thinking clearly. So, fasten your seatbelts now. I'm going to go on a quick race. Over the last century and a half, the number of people in the world has increased sevenfold, and the average person has had their consumption of energy above that necessary to maintain metabolic processes, which is all our hunter-gatherer ancestors had, by a factor seven. So our footprint on the world in that sense has increased by a factor 50. And some of the implications of that I'm just going to sketch, first for food and water, second for climate change, and thirdly for the other creatures with which we share the world. Peter Vitusek, some 20 years ago, made a rough estimate that somewhere between a quarter and a half of all net terrestrial primary productivity is taken to our use, more than any other species has ever done. To some, like I think President Bush, this is a measure of achievement. Recent analysis of satellite images document that indeed something like 40% of the land surface is modified. Jeffrey Sachs, in his recent book, gives a figure more like 45%. If you look at water supplies, currently humanity takes to its purposes 60% of all runoff water, most of it for agriculture, and plausible projections of where increasing demand for water, particularly as developing economies reach from being more vegetarian to eating meat, the rising demands for water intersect the sustainable supply, put the figure somewhere around the middle of the century. Perhaps the headline figure underlining this Of all the atoms of nitrogen fixed in green plant material last year, it's the fourth most important atom after hydrogen, carbon, oxygen in living stuff, more than half came from artificial fossil fuel energy subsidized fertilizers rather than natural biogeochemical processes. I'm not going to read everything on every slide. I don't understand why people do that. I assume you can read. Secondly, climate change. For some reason, that is the trendy thing of the moment, and we're not talking about population or feeding them. Again, the headline statistic here is that for all the talk of renewables, 90% of the energy we consume is putting greenhouse CO2 and other greenhouse gases, mainly CO2, into the atmosphere. And of the 10% that's renewable globally, two-thirds of it is nuclear, and the sum total of all hydro, geothermal, wind turbines is 3%. There are those who would argue, more in this country than in most of the civilized world, that there is still a lot of room for doubt as to whether there's a problem here. The academies of the G8 countries, the US, Japan, Britain, Germany, France, Italy, Canada, Russia, along with China, India, and Brazil, issued this statement a couple of years ago saying, climate change is real. It's human-created primarily, and it's deeply serious. The British government's recent study conducted by Nicholas Stern estimated that the cost by the middle of the century could be somewhere between 5, but more realistically 15% or more of global GDP, whereas the costs of effective action against it lie in a range of a benefit of 3% to a cost of 5%. If we lived in a truly rational world, we would be making different bets. Most of these discussions of environmental problems are focused on the implications for us. The implications for the rest of the living world are every bit as serious. This is a corner of the Bronx Zoo where there's a mini graveyard created indeed by one of the Princeton X students, Anna Marie Lyle, with tombstones for creatures with certified extinctions. You can't read the details, but they're all birds or mammals. They're all furries or featheries that we have more emotional engagement with. If you move to a more dispassionate analysis, this is from the IUCN Red Data books, using rules of classification of endangerment that are the sort of things that underpin what the customs confiscate under the conventional international trade in endangered species, the IUCN things created by Georgina Mace and Russ Landy largely. There's a column there for the vertebrates that we know relatively well, for plants and for insects, of the fraction of all known species that are listed as endangered or probably extinct. And then in the other column, a rather different classification, which is to divide the number endangered by the number that have actually been evaluated, which makes not much difference for mammals and birds because we know them well, but makes a huge difference for insects. I mean, invertebrates, which are at least 100 times more numerous than vertebrates, and which arguably are the small things that run the world, receive the same taxonomic systematic attention as the vertebrates, even though the ratio of plausible numbers is 1 to 100. The total number of endangered insects in relatively recent IUCN, extinct insects rather, total number of extinct insects is 73, of which 43 are Hawaiian Drosophila. and of which not one is a mainland tropical insect. In summary, we don't even know, to within a factor 10, exactly how many different species of plants and animals there are alive today. We don't even know to within 10% how many different ones we've named, because the problems of synonymies for invertebrates are still being resolved. And so we can't give you any sensible number as to numbers going extinct. But what can be done, you can make an estimate assuming birds and mammals are typical. There's no reason to assume they're not, though maybe they aren't, by comparing extinction rates over the past century with the average rate of extinction in the sweep of the fossil record, the average lifetime of a species from origination to extinction. That suggests a speeding up of a factor somewhere between 100 and 1,000 over the last century, and there are four different lines of arguments of differing approaches and degree of rigor that suggest a further extinction. There's no doubt that we are living in a time, we are living on the breaking tip of the sixth great wave of extinction in the history of life on Earth. It's not going to happen in the next half a dozen decades. It's going to unfold slowly over the next few centuries. Long for us, a blink of an eyelid in geological time. That summarized perhaps better in this from the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, where on your left there is extinctions per 1,000 species as shown in the fossil record for marine species or mammals. It's compared with mammals, birds, amphibians in the past century, and these dodgier and less precise ways of projecting future. But that lift from the lower left to the upper right is squarely there on the scale that did in the dinosaurs. The difference being that this is us, not some natural event. And the implications, this is one of these slides just to add verisimilitude to an otherwise bald and unconvincing narrative. It's a table that summarizes the 24 categories of ecosystem service that the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment identified. And then against each of them it said, well, are we getting better, are we getting worse, and why? But the summary is 15 of the 24 are getting worse. 4 associated with food production are actually in reasonable shape and getting better at the moment, and 5 are not evaluatable. An assessment of the likely economic value of ecosystem services is not part of conventional GDP, you know, that strange mystical religion that is taught in Economics 101 and which has no existence largely outside that rather closed area of belief. But when you do make a rough estimate, as most of you know, as has been done, you get something that is of the same scale as conventional GDP. Conventional GDP, when an oil tanker goes aground, that's a good thing. Positive contribution to GDP for cleaning it up. This is the WWF attempt to assess the amount of land needed to sustain humanity's activities going back to the 60s, forward to the most recent date for which I had it. It's a mixture of numbers of people and impact per people, per person, with each increasing. And the horizontal line is an estimate of the globe's sustainable input. This is the basis of a projection that the way we're heading, if everybody continued developing, we'd need a few more planets. It's a dodgy and imprecise estimate. Some of the imprecisions cancel out when you compare the estimate of what's sustainable with what's happened, but there's an imprecision of 10, 20, maybe three decades. But we're living in that time. It's a time of gross inequities, and the actions we need to be taking require actions that are equitably proportionate. You can look there. These are categorized by region. The big orange one to your left is North America. At half the footprint per person is the European Union. The dotted lines show what's sustainable as a footprint, and both are grossly in excess of it. And the long green bit is China and India, Indonesia, which actually is also exceeding what's sustainable and is overall a bigger footprint because although per capita it's a seventh or an eighth of the US, there are a hell of a lot more capitas. The notion that they're going to develop to the living standard enjoyed by this country, where when I arrived in my hotel room, I discovered that the thermostat was set to 63 degrees Fahrenheit to keep the room cool. Had it been winter, the bloody thermostat would have been 75 degrees. But the notion that China is going to get even halfway to America fails to recognize the finiteness of the planet. And I conclude this first half of the talk with a slide. This is not some touchy-feely, greeny slide. This is a UK Ministry of Defence slide. It is an attempt to identify areas of the world under problems of water scarcity, blue, demographic pressures, population pressures, orange, crop decline, green, hunger, brown, coastal inundation. And then the stars are the MOD's estimates of significant recent conflicts. The correlation isn't perfect, but it's very interesting. That's the end of part one. I now turn to part two to say, if we are to do something about this, how much do we understand what we're doing? I said earlier, ecological science goes back, the associations go back about a century. I would myself say the first truly ecological work was The Natural History of Selborne, the work of Gilbert White here, canonized in a sort of St. Francis way in the stained glass window in the church in Selborne. And the reason I accord this status to him is it's one of the very first works that goes beyond cabinets of curiosities to ask modern questions. He observes that many of the bird populations seem to vary a lot from year to year. One of the bee populations are sometimes there, sometimes not. But the swifts are fairly constant, about eight pairs year after year. And Gilbert White says, and I used this too in the MacArthur lecture 22 years ago, the number that I constantly find are eight pairs, about half of which reside in the church and the rest in some of the lowest and meanest thatched cottages. Now, as these eight pairs, allowance being made for accidents, breed yearly eight pairs more, what becomes annually of the increase? What determines every spring which pairs shall visit us and reoccupy their ancient haunts? John Lawton and I went back to Selborne, not to recount the swifts, but to ask the local birders about the swifts, thus conducting what I claim is the longest baseline experiment in ecology. And to these days, there are 12. The church has all stopped up to keep out the squirrels. The lowest and meanest cottages are gentrified, and if they're thatched, it's wired anyhow. The Swifts don't use that. Nobody can tell me what regulates the swift population. Simply, it's not simply breeding sites. But here we are. He started it. And that was still about the stage we were at 40, 50 years ago, although Hutchinson, MacArthur, and people were, Elton, Lack, were beginning to ask those questions. It is astonishing how far we've come in that short distance. And I'm going to give you a slightly narcissistic brief reminder that it was ecologists more than any other discipline thinking about populations that grew in discrete steps with a growth rate A from one generation to the next, but dampened in a crude cartoon cutout of the real feedback processes that might help provide density-dependent regulation, just call it 1 minus X. And when you look at that thing, you discover that yes, if the growth rate, if it's not too boom and busty, if the density dependence isn't too strong, you settle to steadiness. If it gets stronger, you get nice regular oscillations, and if it's too strong, you get things that not only look random, but are so sensitive to the initial condition that one part in a thousand error, a few generations, has given you a quite different answer. Now, that's important in enriching our understanding of the dynamics of populations, but it actually goes much deeper than that. It undercuts what people of my generation thought was the Newtonian dream, or the dream that goes back to Galileo. Galileo said, the grand book of the natural world is written in the language of mathematics. Its characters are triangles, circles, and other geometric objects. Well, maybe God is a mathematician, but he sure didn't confine himself to triangles, circles, and geometric objects. So we now understand that the real book of mathematics is written in terms of fractal geometries, chaotic orbits, things that not only look random, but even if you know the equations, which ecologists never do rigorously, even if you really have the equations, like the Navier-Stokes equations for local weather, you still aren't ever going to be able to predict beyond 20 days. At the time when this was first being pointed out, and many people forget, many people feel ecologists couldn't have done that, ecologists must have been borrowing from other areas of physics. It was some of the early papers, particularly Jim York's paper on period three implies chaos. It was a biological problem being looked at by Jim York that gave us the word chaos. And at the time, however, there were quite a few ecologists that even if they had recognized that would have been embarrassed by it, and there was a lot of feeling it couldn't be relevant to real populations. But much subsequent work, this is one of the things of Constantino and his colleagues showing chaos in laboratory populations. And these next two slides, which I'm not going to explain in detail in the interest of time, are just to remind us, again, go back 30 years. One of the really long baseline experiments in ecology is the lynx hair data inferred from the Hudson Bay trading figures. Relatively regular 11-year cycles. There were those who said, it's predator-prey cycle. It's the lynx eating the hare. There were others, David Lack was one of them, who said it's the hare and their food. Actually, as I did say in Model Ecosystems in 73, if you take the basic predator-prey model, then you wouldn't expect it to cycle. If you take the basic food supply or density dependence within the population, you wouldn't expect it to be a cycle. But if you put the two basic things together, density dependent limitation plus a predator, then you get a cycle. And that, interestingly, is what Nils Stenseth got when he used fancy techniques of the flip side of chaos. If chaos tells you there's basically something simple, but it's giving you things that look random, The flip side is you show me something that looks complicated. Maybe that doesn't necessarily mean that there isn't some simple, relatively deterministic thing. And there are techniques that are being applied in the economic sector of using this as a new approach to nonlinear forecasting. But what Stenseth did is look at the lynx hair data and decide that what it said was there was some two-dimensional, two-variable system influencing the hair, but the lynx were just going along. They were sort of one-dimensional. Doesn't say what the biological things are, but it opens a new window of investigation. As my third example of the kinds of things, there are so many other interesting things one could talk about. I choose this one for a variety of personal reasons. That's the cover illustration of a recent issue of Nature, where there's a paper co-authored by one of Princeton students, Tony Ives, and one of the people from Oxford, Vincent Jansen, and two people in Iceland, who went to visit a rather inaccessible lake in the middle of Iceland called Lake Mirvan. And that has personal resonance for me, because by a peculiar coincidence, some 20 years ago, I was at a meeting in Reykjavik, and Jared Diamond, who had wanted to go to this lake in order that he could tick some birds he hadn't seen, had arranged to hire a plane to fly him to the north of Iceland, and he said, would you like to come along for the day? We probably won't get to eat because we're going to have to leave early and get back. And he said, and there will be some midges and flies around. And when we got there, the place was more like a liquid than a gas of these midges and things. And I sat in the car and looked out, and Jared told me the birds I should come back and tell my British friends I had seen to make them envious. Well, Ives and Jansen and their collaborators did something a little more quantitative, because if you look at this system, it has a peculiar feature that most years there are lots of the midges, but every now and again there's a dip for a few years, and the dips are relatively regular. Their Icelandic colleagues, whose names I'm too embarrassed to try to pronounce, had the data, and when you used that data, they came to the conclusion that this is a system with two alternative stable states. One of them is a steady value, and one of them is a cycle. And when you combine, that's a very interesting example of a real-world system that not only has two alternative stable states, but one of them is a cycle rather than being two stable points. And then when that's kicked around and by environmental fluctuations, you get this mixture that you see. At least it's a nice story. What we need to deal with, however, is much more complex than that. We need to be dealing with the dynamics of whole communities of interacting species and asking these questions. How are they assembled? How is environmental predictability affected? And in particular, how do they respond when we mess around with them? That third question, it is increasingly clear that the answers depend both on the structure of the food web and on the strengths of the individual connections within that food web. And I'm going to witter on for a little bit about this, because this again takes us back to the late 60s, early 70s, when it was felt, partly as the result of work by Elton, and Evelyn Hutchinson had enunciated it as one of the few things we really understand, that complicated ecosystems are better able to handle disturbance simply by virtue of being complicated. And that struck some people, notably Ken Watt at Davis, as not in accord with common sense. And it was reading Ken Watt's book which was the event that accidentally prompted me to say, I think Ken Watt's right, let's look at these arguments. And indeed, if you take the simplest thing you can think of a community of N species, each of which, if by itself had internal regulatory, had density-dependent mechanisms that interact, when I say by itself, for some reason or another, would be stable. And now you let them interact, predator and prey, competitor, mutualists, at random. Put in connections at random. Let the magnitudes of the correct... And do it very simple. It's a toy model. It's a cartoon. Randomly constructed complexity. And we'll assume that the average strengths of the interactions that exist is something with magnitude alpha compared to the internal regulatory effects. And you discover that that system represents a generalization of a physical theorem due to Jean Wigner for anti-symmetric Hermitian matrices that says if there are too many connections or the interactions are too strong, then when you've got a lot of species, the thing simply will tip from instability according to that criterion, which has nothing to do with the real world, but at least refocused our attention on what is the job. And as emphasized 36 years ago, real food webs are not randomly constructed. They're the results of evolution acting on individuals, affecting the dynamics of populations, and ultimately affecting those systems that over time have persisted in the face of environmental challenges. The progress we've made there is remarkable, and this slide says it defies any simple summary. And now I'm going to take 5 or 10 minutes to give a summary of some of the things that defy summary, but they're a chosen subset of the generality. I particularly like two recent analyses that have taken a lot of fairly high-resolution food webs, both aquatic and terrestrial, and looked at their topology, not looking at the strengths, just the topology. And they find there are consistent patterns. They're much more, one species is more type, you don't have to go as far from one species to another in the web, if you think of it as an abstract topological entity, as you'd expect. And the distribution of number of species that are connected to one other, two other, three other, is very different from random. There's one very fashionable area that thinks everything is scale-free. It goes a particular distribution, and this is mainly done by appropriate massaging of the data and taking logarithms, which gets rid of most of the data. And when you look at this more carefully, you discover that usually they're not scale-free, but they are long-tailed. There are lots of problems with this work. Again, much progress, but lots of problems. Part of the problem is going back to the furry-feathery problem. People like birds and mammals and other attractive vertebrates, but when you get down to the invertebrates, well, spiders, cockroaches, moths. And that's a bit of a problem if you're trying to understand the structure and function of an ecosystem. And there's interestingly, as Stufer at Northwestern has recently pointed out, a further complication that ecologists are familiar with from earlier work on trying to document what are patterns of species relative abundance and then test that against possible explanations. And it turns out that lots of different explanations give you the same statistical pattern, which is very irritating. And Stufer has shown that too for food webs. He's shown as we now get these patterns, rather irritatingly, at least two of the very different mechanisms proposed for how the webs are assembled give you the same pattern. So there's lots of problems. Even so, it does look as if there are some quite significant generalizations and that they apply, at least in freshwater estuarine, much the same as terrestrial. So a paper in Nature just last month by Curis and Dobson and some other people, a very big collaboration, that really did try to go in much more detail and look not just at the invertebrates, but the parasites, the members of the community that are hidden inside other members of the community. It's a fascinating paper, not least because it suggests that the biomass of the internal parasites exceeds the biomass in these estuarine ecosystems of all the external vertebrate and invertebrate predators, which, if true, is quite extraordinary. And it connects with another recent piece of work by Mercedes Pascual and others that have gone back to the spirit of the 70s, as it were, but armed with the vastly greater computer power we have, and said, if we just take these randomly assembled food webs that I was talking about a moment ago, and let's randomly assemble these things 10,000 times, so we've got an assembly with some degree of connectivity, and at random we've treated things as predator-prey, competitors or mutualists, are there any significant patterns that emerge? And the significant pattern that emerges very strikingly is that of the 10,000 simulated food webs, the ones that survive, that are robust, stable, have a disproportionately large number of predator-prey interactions. And that's something that irritatingly one could have done 30 years ago analytically to a certain extent, but I never thought of doing it. And that was, I realized that was a little bit technical, but it was to try to give you a sense of the progress that I think, the remarkable progress we've made. And it has some quite interestingly odd applications. This is a penultimate bit. I realize a lot of people have to be other places, and I'm going to be finished on the hour, pretty much. Recently, the U.S. National Academy of Sciences and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and this was before the subprime mortgage crisis, put together one of the NAS study things to look at systemic risk in financial systems. So these, after all, are systems that are a bit like ecosystems because they're assembled by lots of individual companies and selfish individuals doing stuff with other people having vague ideas about what might be a good idea and a bad idea after the various hiccups there have been going back to 1929. And the idea of the report was to say, are there lessons we can take from ecology, from the electricity grid, from things like that? And it did turn out that ecology tended to be highlighted this, partly because, just to summarize what I was saying a moment ago, there are lots of kinds of regularities that we think we're seeing in ecosystems. And again, another paper of Jennifer Dunn's, recent and a bit controversial but fascinating, you look back at deductions from fossil assemblages from the Cambrian from 550 million years ago, and you see some of the same patterns, and you even see some systematic changes as more recent Burgess Shale compared to earlier Cambrian tend to have more patterns of hierarchical structures of the kind we see in today's ecosystems rather than the many loops you see in some of the earliest ones. So, are there crosstalk between some of this? George Sugihara suggested, and George Sugihara is somebody who got quite involved in the financial things coming out of his ecology thesis, which was largely on the flip side of chaos. They commissioned a study of the Fedwire money transfer system that you're all familiar with. 9,500 banks, half of them involved on the average day, transferring about 1.2 trillion a day. And they asked, what's the topology of this Fedwire system? Well, it just looks like a hairball if you look at it. But when you get down to it, it has an immense amount of structure. 66 of the 9,500 banks account for 75% of all the transactions. 25 of the banks are connected to everybody. The big banks aren't strongly connected to each other. They're connected to the little banks, and the little banks are connected typically to one big bank. It's a system whose topology has features of ecosystems. And it suggests messages, and indeed I brought with me part of my email correspondence with one of my friends who happens these days to be the governor of the Bank of England, and he said he thought that this really was relevant to thinking about best ways of preventing financial crises. For one thing, the idea that heterogeneous investment strategies might reduce contagion has, in my view, a good deal of force. It's possible that regulation might inadvertently encourage uniform strategies and hence increase the underlying degree of instability. Of course, there are good arguments for regulation, but the way in which it's done can cause problems themselves, the most obvious example being the pro-cyclical aspects of the new Basel II regulations for capital requirements for banks and so on. So in short, I think we made a lot of progress, and I think we're making progress faster than the banking system is. So I conclude, and I want to conclude, first of all, by finding the page of my notes I'm on. Yep. What I've been trying to suggest, and it may not be right, but I think it is, that firstly, it is simply a fact that we're standing on the edge of a precipice. It's not going to happen tomorrow. It's not going to happen in 10 years. For the people like me, life is going to go on and be okay. For the younger people, it's going to get a bit grubbier. And for their kids, it's going to be, it could be really, really bad. We have the tools to address it. The tools come primarily from this meeting, the climate change modelers, all sorts of other disciplines are important, but our advancing understanding, the maturation of ecology as a beyond a descriptive to a conceptual science, is giving us the tools that would enable us to address these problems. The real question is, will we do it? My second advertisement, in which I have no personal interest, is for Jared Diamond's book on collapse, a study of societies that have addressed problems successfully and those that have addressed them unsuccessfully. In fact, in the context of will we do it, I'm very fond of a remark made by Daniel Powley once I heard at a fisheries conference. I mean, you understand, while I was talking about population, our advancing understanding, having made steps forward, I could have talked about the way epidemiology has enabled us to manage foot and mouth and SARS and will help if we get our act together for H5N1. I could have talked about advances in understanding the collapse of fisheries. But the fact is, as Daniel Powley, wonderful phrase, we know enough about fisheries to manage them sustainably. It's just that we don't. Powley said, fisheries science is as if we were building marvelous new hospitals and you could come in and get diagnosed. We just didn't treat you. That's the question. Jared asks it in the form of a metaphor based on Easter Island. There's a flourishing society on Easter Island, many different tribal groups living in harmony, each with their tribal gods. An economy based mainly on the sea, which depended on trees for canoes. But they cut down the trees. The society came to an end, and it's not everybody agrees, but it seems fairly clear it was simply the collapse of the economy. And what did the people do? Did they get together to address it? No, they fought among themselves and pulled down each other's icons. And Jared says, what did they do as they cut down the last trees? Did they say, it's jobs, not trees? Did they say, we need more research, it's not certain? Did they say, I will if you will, and that gave way to I won't if you won't? Fact is, they probably didn't understand what was happening. We don't have that excuse, and quite improperly I end by saying we'll be in much better shape to have a hope if the election goes right in November.